wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is part 15 of the Wizards of Money series, and it is entitled Homeland Securitizations and Overseas Vacations. It's a journey through the financial twilight zone. In this, the 15th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at the adventures that financial institutions send their financial instruments on, both at home and abroad. On this journey through the financial twilight zone, we'll take a look at some of the financial tricks receiving a lot of attention in today's corporate and banking scandals, as well as the rescue packages available for homeland capital getting into trouble in its overseas adventures. On the issue of homeland securitization, we'll first look at the process known as securitization, whereby anything that has a stream of cash flows emerging in the future can be bundled up into a new financial security and sold for cash today. And that literally means anything with a future stream of cash flows. From home loan and credit card repayments, to David Bowie songs and football ticket sales, to health club membership fees, to insurance against bad weather, and to the delivery of oil and gas by the now famous energy companies. We will start with a look at the biggest homeland securitization market of all, that for home mortgages, and some of its biggest players, from the banks to the mysterious bodies known as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We will look at the use of securitization and its associated special purpose vehicles as tools for regulatory avoidance and enhanced returns, and as the catalyst for urban sprawl and daily credit card solicitations. We'll also study the generation of what is known as toxic sludge on federally insured bank balance sheets, the relationship between securitization and the secret over-the-counter derivatives casino, as well as the hidden systemic risks that don't get much attention. In studying overseas vacations, we will see how a summer trip to a Caribbean island or a Swiss chalet for the snow season can provide great regulatory relief for a stressed-out financial instrument securitized in the homeland. We will take a critical look at the additional risks all this regulatory avoidance poses for each of us as bank depositors and taxpayers.
Every day I see you wearing things that have never been worn before. While the children at the government school send money for the poor. Naughty by you bargain for with your little man. So from silks down to your paramour, treacherous paragon. So it's a backbeat in the summer, the chalet for the snow. You poor boots, your boots, your feet, your roots, your mama, you got really no place to grow.
To get started, we need to cross into a whole new dimension, the world in between the two endpoints of a financial instrument or transaction. Just like the twilight zone wedged in between day and night, this strange world in between a debt on my balance sheet and an asset on somebody else's books is occupied by a cast of characters the majority of people just can't quite see. You might have heard some of the names or some rumours about them, but you can never quite see them clearly. Before crossing into this other world, underlying the financial system, let's just get a taste of how the regular daytime world we are used to interacts with this other dimension we can't see. We all interact with the financial instruments at one end or another of this mysterious twilight zone of financial transactions. We do this by buying a home, shopping with a credit card, buying an insurance policy, having a pension fund, or even going to watch a movie or buying a book or a CD. But few are aware that each such everyday action triggers a complex chain of events rippling through the financial ether world. For example, your home mortgage may have got bundled up with thousands of others, packed into a special purpose vehicle and shuttled off to some remote island, split into five different tranches, four of which have been bought and sold at least 10 times in the market, and one of which ended up in the pension fund of your cousin in Chile. Layered on top of these five tranches are hundreds of derivatives contracts swapped over and again throughout the global financial markets, one of whose positions was, quite by coincidence, taken by the insurance company you bought a policy with when you took out your mortgage. In addition, you might be interested to know that this insurance policy is actually no longer with the insurer you bought it from. It's already off on a European vacation after being passed to a pool of European reinsurers and, in the process of crossing the Atlantic Ocean, managed to drop the extra baggage of safety nets required by US regulators to ensure the security of your future claims. So then, what is going on? To get started in understanding this other dimension, you need to get into a special purpose vehicle to cross into the financial twilight zone.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Now having passed into the Twilight Zone in the only vehicle that can get you there, now you are going to have a look around at the scenery and at the main players. Entering the Twilight Zone, the first thing you will notice is that the atmosphere is thick with financial securities, and this takes the place of the regular air we are used to in the regular daylight world. The quality and quantity of this Twilight Zone atmosphere is regulated by the character known as the investment bankers, who seem to be everywhere. Travelling around the Twilight Zone, you see some familiar faces. They look like the federally insured banks that we are used to seeing during our daily lives, except that they are dressed a bit differently and they look very relaxed. Some, saying they are on a trip to Bermuda or the Bahamas, are dressed in their shorts and swimming outfits. Others, dressed up in their skiing gear, say they are touring the Swiss Alps. All in all, they say that the paths through the Caribbean islands, the Channel Islands, and Switzerland make travel through the Twilight Zone a lot smoother. And certainly, one can easily see that, in this environment, the bankers are much more friendly and easy to get along with than when you come across them in the broad daylight. Well, one thing that's a bit unsettling about them, though, when you look behind their banking houses, you see piles of toxic sludge that nobody in the Twilight Zone wants to talk about. When you question the bankers about whether this toxic sludge is going to get cleaned up, the cheerful disposition suddenly vanishes and they give you a look that clearly says, if you keep asking questions like that, you'll never make it back out into the broad daylight.
One time in a minute, a coin will land on its edge. But all it takes to knock it over is a vagrant breeze, a vibration or a slight blow. Hector B. Poole, a human coin, on edge for a brief time. in the Twilight Zone.
Quickly moving on from that tense situation, you come across the insurers, who you are also used to seeing in your daily life. They are dressed up in a similar fashion to the bankers, though they are not exactly as happy, they say, since they don't have the support of the Federal Deposit Insurance. However, it's the good deals from their mentors, the global reinsurers, that seem to cheer them up a lot. Up over the horizon, you see two huge bodies, actually bigger than most of the bankers and insurers, dotting the landscape. You can never quite make them out, even when you get up close, but they introduce themselves anyway, as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's hard to tell what they really are, and the information you get from them is quite confusing. You ask them, "Are you private bodies or are you government bodies?" And you never get a straight answer. In fact, every time you ask, Freddie says private and Fannie says government, and then the next time you ask, it's the other way around. As always, in travel throughout the Twilight Zone, investors are always whizzing by, but when you ask them, they seem to be just as confused about the status of Fannie and Freddie. So it's best just to give up and move on. Usually, if you're confused about the atmosphere of securitizations, you can go ask one of the investment bankers. For example, if you're confused about a certain type of financial instrument, you can ask them, "Is that a debt or equity or maybe even a trading liability?" They'll usually respond with something like, "Well, that depends. What would you like it to be?" And they can make exactly what you wish for, just like magic.
It was a very small, misery-laden village on the day of a hanging, and of little historical consequence. And if there's any moral to it at all, let's say that in any quest for magic, in any search for sorcery, witchery, leisure domain, first check the human heart. For inside this deep place is a wizardry that costs far more than a few pieces of gold. Tonight's case in point, in the Twilight Zone.
Moving along, we can just make out the outline of some very dark objects, never seen in broad daylight, called the hedge funds. They seem to congregate in and around a great big dark building, also never seen in the daytime, called the Derivatives Casino. The car park at the casino is packed full with special purpose vehicles. The bankers and insurers are often seen coming and going into and out of this building, but only in the Twilight Zone and never in broad daylight, of course, since the casino doesn't even exist in broad daylight. At the center of the Twilight Zone is a complete black box, almost like a black hole. But instead of everything being pulled towards it, what happens is that every time there is but a little ripple emanating from the black box, it seems to cause a much bigger effect throughout the rest of the Twilight Zone, first hitting the banks and then jolting Fannie and Freddie so that they sometimes lose their balance. In this way, a little ripple from the black box, once it passes through the banks and Fannie and Freddie, gets much magnified in its impact on the rest of the players. They call this black box, of course, the central bank, or sometimes the Federal Reserve. Such ripples that get magnified many times over can also come from other parts of the Twilight Zone. Lots of times you can even see the implosion of one of the dark objects known as the hedge funds, or the crash of one of the larger speeding investors, cause massive waves throughout the Twilight Zone. Interestingly, ripples can also come from the daylight world that we all live in, cross into this other dimension to cause massive destabilization, and then ripple back out to the daylight world. Well, I think that's enough of our visit for now. Once you get back in your special purpose vehicle and travel back into the regular daylight world, where the regular people live, this amazingly intricate other world, known as the financial Twilight Zone, completely disappears from view. But you know it's still there.
beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Now that we're back out of the Twilight Zone and can think clearly, let's talk in some detail about what we've just seen, starting with the composition of the atmosphere, or the securities. But we can't do that without first discussing those confusing objects called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that we just met in the financial Twilight Zone. Securitization in its modern form was, like many a financial invention, initially born out of desperate times. Recall that in Wizards Part 10, we spoke of the regulatory blitz of the 1930s during the Great Depression that brought in many new banking and stock market rules, such as the Glass-Steagall Act and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Such regulatory blitzes really only come along in times of utter desperation, like a complete financial and economic collapse. And they only come along because they have to. Because you can't get the economy up and running unless you bring in some regulations to bring back confidence, the main ingredient for a functioning economy. Restoring confidence in the financial system and stimulating credit creation was a primary aim of the banking rules and federal deposit insurance implemented during the Great Depression that was discussed in Wizards Part 10. This was also the primary aim of another act we did not get to speak about in Wizards Part 10, and that is the National Housing Act of 1934. The National Housing Act saw the introduction of the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, whose primary function was to provide insurance of home mortgage loans made by private lenders. This insurance meant that a lender would be repaid by the government in the event of loss on default by mortgagees. During such hard economic times, this mandate of the FHA would stimulate credit creation by banks and other lenders for investment in home building, which in turn would provide more affordable housing and create jobs and stimulate further economic growth. Simultaneously, the government insurance backing would shore up confidence in the now shaken and much mistrusted financial sector. The practical implementation of this federal mortgage insurance took the form of the chartering of a government corporation to buy and sell the mortgages that the government would insure. The first such corporation was set up in 1938 and called the Federal National Mortgage Association, also known simply as Fannie Mae. In 1968, they split Fannie Mae into two and made a twin sister out of her that they called Ginny Mae, short for the Government National Mortgage Association. Ginny stayed with the government doing what Fannie used to do, and Fannie ventured off into the private markets. Fannie became fully owned by private shareholders, yet with a charter and mandate specified by Congress. Instead of complying with SEC rules and other rules that apply to private enterprises, Fannie is instead regulated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, who tells her basically what business to be in, and is also regulated by the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, who monitors her financial stability. Occupying that very special area of the financial Twilight Zone that is not quite government and not quite private enterprise, Fannie Mae is instead referred to as a government-sponsored enterprise, or GSE. Before long, it was thought that the May sisters were lonely, and so they made up a cousin officially called the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, now known as Freddie Mac, who looks a lot more like Fanny than Ginny. Freddie is another DSE, or government-sponsored enterprise, owned by private shareholders but regulated by HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The job of Fannie and Freddie has been to provide an active secondary market for the home mortgages of low to middle income families. That is, while they don't make home loans directly themselves, they buy individual home mortgages from primary lenders such as banks and mortgage companies, package together bunches of these loans and sell them back into the capital markets as mortgage-backed securities. The primary objective of creating such active secondary markets for these mortgages is to make sure that enough capital is available for affordable mortgages for families with low to moderate incomes. Without the ability to sell off such mortgages for cash to another party, banks and other lenders would make either less loans in the low to moderate income groups, or they would charge higher interest rates for fear of default and burdensome foreclosures. Up until the 1980s, the mortgage-backed securities issued by these entities looked more like what is known as simple pass-throughs, whereby an investor in a security issued by Fannie or Freddie simply got a share of the interest and principal paid by the underlying group of mortgagees, with a guarantee on repayment provided by Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae. But the deregulatory blitz of the 1980s ushered in the rise to power of the investment banking class and the corresponding rapid development and population of that paralleled world known as the financial twilight zone that we got to visit earlier. And so began a totally new world of asset securitization, the very stuff underlying this parallel financial universe.
These are the invaders, the tiny beings from the tiny place called Earth, who would take the giant step across the sky to the question marks that sparkle and beckon from the vastness of a universe only to be imagined. The invaders, who found out that a one-way ticket to the stars beyond has the ultimate price tag. And we have just seen it entered in a ledger that covers all the transactions of the universe. A bill stamp paid in full, and to be found on file in the Twilight Zone.
One of the problems with the pass-through type securities mentioned earlier is that the cash flow stream is uncertain. It can be very long, with long fixed rate mortgages, and can also change suddenly if interest rates drop and mortgagees decide to prepay their loans. This can make such investments quite unattractive to, say, long-term investors such as pension funds and insurance companies who are looking for guaranteed payments long into the future. Furthermore, shorter-term investors might find these instruments altogether unattractive. Investment bankers of the 1970s and 80s invented a different type of mortgage-backed security to get around these problems. Basically, given a pool of home mortgages, you could come up with a series of different tranches of securities or bonds or notes that you would issue against the pool. The first or senior tranche from the pool would have a fixed interest rate and set principal repayments and be the first set of cash flows to be paid out of the pool. The next tranche might only get interest payments and then start getting principal only when the senior tranche is fully paid off, and so on, all the way down to the so-called Z tranche, or the toxic sludge of leftovers that only gets repaid once every other tranche is repaid. The senior tranche is the most secure instrument and so gets the lowest interest rate. The toxic tranche is more like a speculative investment and has a higher potential yield, but also high risk associated with it. In this way, a pool of pretty unglamorous and ordinary mortgages could give birth to a smorgasbord of different financial instruments to suit anyone's tastes. The wild capital markets of the 1980s thought that this was just about the most fantastic monetary invention since fractional reserve banking, and they were wild about it. Fannie and Freddie alone grew to have trillions of dollars of home loans under their belts using this new wizardry. Not only has this invention helped the GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, provide ever more capital for home financing, it has also facilitated secondary markets in mortgage-backed securities issued by various other bank and non-bank entities. This invention that was able to turn the humdrum home mortgage into a slew of fancy securities to match anyone's desires multiplied the attractiveness of mortgage-backed securities many times over, and consequently, capital has been flooding into the mortgage market ever since. In retrospect, then, you might put more blame for the phenomenon of urban sprawl on the investment bankers than anyone else. But the growth of the financial twilight zone did not stop there, for it was soon realized that anything with a future stream of cash flows could be bundled up in such a fashion and have a set of designer financial instruments issued against that bundle. By the late 1980s, auto loan and credit card receivables were being bundled up in such a fashion. By the 1990s, the securitization market was extended to cover future record and movie sales, health club membership fees, tax liens, life insurance policies, and catastrophe insurance, to name but a few. Name anything with a future stream of cash flows, and it can be securitized. Notably also, in the late 1990s, we also saw securitization become used more and more by banks to sell corporate loans off to the capital markets. Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase's activities in this area have recently received a lot of attention, as we shall discuss later. Securitization is attractive to both the issuer and the investor in the new securities for various reasons. We already talked about how these instruments have been designed to be attractive to the investor. For the issuer, that is, the one who originated the mortgages or first hooked you on a credit card, securitization has several attractions. One, especially so for banks, is to free up regulatory capital or the safety net for depositors that we spoke extensively about in Wizards Part 2 and Wizards Part 11, so that this capital can be used in the next wizard adventure. Another attraction of securitization is the removal of certain undesirable assets from the balance sheet and the removal of them into so-called off-balance sheet vehicles. Other attractions include that securitizations issued through an SPV or special purpose vehicle can be a cheaper way of raising capital and increasing liquid assets rather than having to go directly to the capital and debt markets. What this explosion in securitization has done is to create an explosion in the availability of capital for investment in whatever is being securitized. Hence, we've seen an explosion in credit card offers, home equity loans and basic home loans, auto loans, media and entertainment financing, and also various corporate adventures that have received a lot of attention recently. like placing the blame for the explosion in urban sprawl in the past decade, you might also need to credit the innovative investment bankers for all the credit card solicitations you get every day, as well as the design of transactions that have allowed corporations to hide debt and perform other accounting wizardry. So anyway, what does all this have to do with special purpose vehicles and the fact that so many characters in the financial ether seem to be hanging out on Caribbean islands, Channel Islands, and in the Swiss Alps? To understand this, we better get back to our special purpose vehicle and look at the mechanics of it. The more traditional special purpose vehicle, or we could call it SPV version 1, works as follows. The party with the loans or other receivables to be securitized is known as the originator, and they transfer these loans or receivables into a special purpose vehicle to isolate them from the originator, hence the ability to take them off balance sheet. The SPV raises funds from the capital markets to pay for these transferred assets, and this money goes back to the originator. The way these SPVs raise funds is by issuing notes or securities in the form of bonds to investors. Such notes or bonds then give these investors a claim on the assets held by the SPV, and, in theory, the claim is supposed to stop there. That is, in a true transfer of risk via this securitization process, there should be no extra claims on the originator. Part of the reason for Enron's rapid demise last year was that in this case, there was a contingent claim of the investors back on the originator, namely Enron, in many of their SPVs. Based on recent regulatory rulings from the main bank regulators, there seems to be some hidden guarantees lurking behind bank securitizations too. This is part of the so-called toxic sludge we spotted earlier in the Twilight Zone. The notes issued against the assets held in the SPV can be designed to give rise to the many types of varieties of instruments to suit different types of investor needs, as we spoke about earlier for mortgage-backed securities. But what's interesting here is that the highest risk tranche, the equivalent of the Z tranche for the mortgage-backed security, also known affectionately as the toxic waste of the securitization, is often retained with the originator. That is, even though it might look like the originator has gotten the assets and associated risks off of its balance sheet, they actually retain the most risky part. And this is in addition to the toxic sludge hidden guarantees we just spoke about that the bank regulators have recently issued statements on. The behaviour of both of these rapidly growing poisonous piles has not yet been tested in an economic downturn. And it's a hidden risk in the financial twilight zone that nobody seems to want to talk about. To avoid any extra taxes, regulations, and disclosure rules associated with putting an SPV between the originator and the investor, especially the more regulated originators, such as the banks, many SPVs are set up in favourable tax and regulatory jurisdictions. Hence, the preponderance of them in places like the Bahamas, Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, the Channel Islands, and so forth. In addition, places like Switzerland and the Switzerland of Latin America, Uruguay, are favourite places for limited taxes, for regulatory avoidance, and for bank secrecy. Following are some interesting words from Senator Carl Levin of the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigations at a July 23, 2002, set of hearings on JP Chase and Citigroup and their use of such vehicles.
The financial institutions provided the structure and the vehicle to create these fake prepaid trades. It attempted to turn debt into cash flow from operations. The critical third party that was provided were offshore shell corporations that existed in secrecy jurisdictions solely for and as the creation of the investment bank. Just a little bit like the Wizard of Oz, when Toto pulls back the curtain to show the Great Oz, is no more than just a old man rapidly manipulating pyrotechnic devices. When you pull back the curtain of the offshore shell companies, it reveals that the banks were calling the shots and pulling the strings. There's no other conclusion that any reasonable person can reach, I believe, but that effective control of those two offshore entities were in the hands of the banks.
We'll hear more about this investigation and what was uncovered later on. Recall that on our journey through the financial twilight zone, we could just make out the figures of the shady hedge funds and the outline of the over-the-counter derivatives casino with a lot of special purpose vehicles in the parking lot. What was all that about, you might be wondering? Recall that we spoke about the OTC or over-the-counter derivatives casino in Wizards Part 11. There are several types of derivatives games that might be played in conjunction with securitization. Let's just talk about a couple of them. First are the derivatives that might be used in relation to interest rates. Take, for example, the huge pools of mortgages on the books at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that are now into the trillions. Fannie and Freddie are buying pools of mortgages from banks and then selling these cash flows off in the form of much different securities. Their revenue from the mortgages will come in over the lives of these mortgages, but their dues back to the securities holders is often due in a different pattern and often over a much shorter period than the mortgages. If interest rates suddenly change direction, Fannie and Freddie could find themselves in a whole lot of trouble. So, they say, they hedge this risk by entering into some offsetting gambles at the OTC derivatives casino. An interest rate derivative contract basically says that your counterparty to the derivatives transaction will reimburse you if interest rates move in a certain direction. But how do we know that this hedging makes them safe and sound? They are not regulated by the bank regulators, nor by the SEC, because of their special status in between something that's government and something that's private. Furthermore, the OTC derivatives market is not regulated at all. How well hedged are Fannie and Freddie? And who are their counterparties? Is it the big US banks? They are, after all, the biggest players at the derivatives casino. What potential risk does this impose on the US bank depositor and taxpayer? Perhaps one of the biggest concerns arises from Fannie and Freddie's peculiar status of being mostly private but partly government bodies. Therefore, there has been a perception among investors in their securities and maybe their derivatives counterparties, i.e. the banks, that Fannie and Freddie would get bailed out by the US taxpayer if they ever got in trouble. This may have led some too big to fail players into risks they should not be taking. But we have no way of knowing, with so much of these markets permanently operating in the twilight zone and never exposed to the daylight.
Object known as a camera. Vintage uncertain, origin unknown. But for the greedy, the avaricious, the fleet of foot, who can run a 4-minute mile so long as they're chasing a fast buck, it makes believe that it's an Alae. But it isn't at all. It's a beckoning come-on for a quick walk around the block in the twilight zone.
Then there are different types of derivatives gambles going on that recently have been causing alarms to sound in the bank regulator circles. This includes the toxic sludge generated by the hidden guarantees that can only be seen in the twilight zone. They look sort of like hidden derivatives or hidden insurance or guarantees. Similar hidden guarantees reared their ugly heads in the Enron scandal, but we have heard much less about these hidden guarantees in terms of what the banks are doing and what the bank regulators have lately been observing on the bankers' books. Shocked by the recent scandals, the four main banking regulators in the US issued a series of so-called supervisory letters on May 23, 2002, about the so-called toxic sludge they have found on the bankers' books. The press generally appears to have missed this. I will post some links to these supervisory letters and some explanations about them to the Wizards of Money website at wizardsofmoney.org. In yet another type of derivatives transaction, corporate credit risk, or the risk of a corporation defaulting, is the main focus. Not only have banks and others been using special purpose vehicles to securitize their corporate bond and loan portfolios, but now they have come up with Special Purpose Vehicle version 100, the virtual special purpose vehicle, to effectively transfer credit risk. These synthetic obligations now come in many forms, from synthetic corporate debt obligations to credit-linked notes to credit default swaps. Without going into how these work, we just note that this is a very new and rapidly growing area of the OTC or over-the-counter derivatives market and has really caught worldwide financial regulators by surprise and actually made them quite nervous. This market is so new that it has not been tested in a down market, and already we saw two such transactions blow up big time in the big bank's face during the Enron scandal. Citigroup had set up a credit default swap transaction through a special purpose vehicle called Yosemite that was a focus of the July 2002 US Senate inquiry into the role of banks in the Enron saga. At the end of the day, the transactions through these vehicles, which appeared to involve oil and gas trades, enabled Enron to disguise true debt as the more appealing trading liabilities, and thus made Enron look like they were in better financial shape than they actually were. Citigroup opted for the Yosemite vehicle structure to enable it to pass the credit risk or risk of default into the capital markets. They surely didn't want to take such risks on themselves. Perhaps they already knew too much about Enron. While the Senate investigations did a good job at revealing this accounting wizardry at Enron, so far neither the Senate nor Congress as a whole, nor the general press, have gotten themselves worried about the broader risks underlying the new and fancy credit derivatives market as a whole, and its total avoidance of the daylight in its 5 or so years of existence. The following is an excerpt from the July 23, 2002 Senate hearing into Citigroup's role in the Enron saga. Included is a description of how the Yosemite vehicles were set up. What's interesting here is that while Senator Fitzgerald initially addresses his question to Maureen Hendricks, a managing director on the investment banking side at Solomon Smith Barney, it is in fact Mr. Richard Kaplan, head of the credit derivatives division at Citigroup, that has to step in and explain the structure. After all, as is explained early on, The Yosemite were his babies. This invention is only befitting of the deepest, darkest warps of the Twilight Zone.
And you came up with the idea of Yosemite?
No, sir. I'm not smart enough.
Who came up with that idea?
Mr. Kaplan and colleagues of his in the credit derivatives group.
This is the credit derivatives guys.
Yes, sir.
They were the only ones smart enough for that. Now, again, you go back and walk me through this transaction slowly. How this worked? You started to explain about the trust and the notes.
Well, maybe I should. The place to really start is the financings that Enron was doing in the bank market, and there were a variety of financings. So the real premise was Enron came to us and said, we do a lot of financing in the bank market. We like doing our financing in the bank
market. Not just the Citibank, but all other
banks. All over the place.
Did they take all their bank borrowings from all over the world and come to you and ask you?
And they said, one of the problems we have with bank financing is that it's short-term, for the reasons that Mr. Bushnell just explained.
Right.
So we would like, but the rest of our balance sheet, we have a lot of long-term assets. So we've got long-term assets and short-term liabilities. That seems like a recipe for disaster at some point if you don't manage those things. So what their premise was is we're a growing company. We have to be carefully thinking about our liquidity plans for the future. And one of the tenets of a carefully thought-out liquidity plan is to better match your assets and your liability maturities. So the thought was, where can you get longer-term debt, effectively? Or where can you place your credit risk in a longer-term market? The logical place is the bond market, because investors will invest for longer terms there. So understanding that they want to have the flexibility to continue to finance in a sophisticated way in the bank market, but wanted to move the credit risk out into the capital markets, we developed Yosemite, which basically the idea behind Yosemite is a credit default swap written from the bond market.
Yosemite is a what?
It's basically a credit default swap, and I'll explain what that means.
What is Yosemite from a legal standpoint?
From a legal standpoint, the first deal was a trust. The second deal was a Channel Islands Corporation, and the other deals were trusts.
Okay, Yosemite 1 was a trust.
Yes.
Was it a Cayman Islands trust?
A Delaware Business Trust.
A Delaware Business Trust. Okay.
So we set up Yosemite.
Right.
Yosemite issued notes and certificates and held the proceeds of those notes and certificates and invested them in it basically had the ability to invest in several different things which were not disclosed to
the, how much did Yosemite One raise?
It raised $750 million of notes and $75 million of equity or certificates, equity for tax purposes.
Who gave the equity?
It was a combination of Citibank and Enron.
So Citibank invested its own bank fund?
Not directly. We did it through, it's a little complicated. We actually, Fleet Bank's conduit, which is something called Long Lane Master Trust. I mean, this is the essence of structured finance, right? Fleet Boston's conduit called Long Lane Master Trust actually bought the Citibank half of the equity, and then that entity, Long Lane Master Trust, entered into a swap with Citibank where we took the risk on the equity and we effectively paid them a financing cost for buying the equity, plus a spread for their.
Did you sell $750 million in notes? Did you sell them in $75 million chunks or $5 million chunks?
I think the minimum denomination was $1 million.
But do you know how many investors you got?
I think in the first deal it was less than 100.
So you had 100 people invested.
All in the 144A market. Which
all in the
144.
And could you give me examples of some of the 144A market buyers?
It's kind of all the major, it's other banks, pension funds, it's insurance companies. It's to be a qualified institutional buyer, you have to have at least $100 million in investable assets. So it's large.
So pension funds, the state pension funds and so forth, could have bought those.
If they met the requirements right. for buying the notes, they could. If they had a qualified asset manager and that sort of thing.
After hearing all this about Yosemite, you might be wondering why investors would be wanting to take on this credit risk by buying the Yosemite notes. Interestingly, one of the conditions specified in the offering prospectus was that investors would not know the details of the assets underlying the Yosemite notes. And these investors turn out to be our trusted banks, insurance companies, and pension funds, with no doubt some big-time hedge funds thrown in for good measure. I think it's best to let the bankers tell this story about the so-called blind trust notes themselves. Here is another excerpt from the July 23, 2002 Senate hearing into Citigroup's role in the Enron saga.
Back in some of the transactions I was talking about earlier, where we did similar 144A offerings and used credit default swaps, we have the same blind trust concept, and investors have asked for information in those transactions as well, and we have again declined to provide the information on the same theory.
I think then that your answer is yes.
I think my answer is a little different than yes, but
it's appropriate to agree to refuse to provide information on request to a prospective investor. Is that correct?
As long as we don't have a legal obligation.
Okay.
Senator, if I might, it is specifically stated in the offering document for Yosemite One that we would not tell investors what was in the trust. And I think that's the point that Mr. Kaplan, the distinction that Mr. Kaplan is trying to draw.
Not to be outdone, J.P. Morgan Chase offered similar debt-hiding transactions to Enron through a vehicle known as Mahonia, based in the Channel Island, Jersey, and, as it turns out, owned by a charitable trust. First, we'll let a Mr. Delapina, Managing Director at Morgan Chase Bank New York, give us a little refresher course on structured finance, securitizations, and how this all applies to their dealings with the energy companies.
These are other forms of transactions that are designed to meet particular financing needs, commonly referred to as structured finance transactions. The structured finance market is very large and is participated in by the world's major financial firms. Examples of structured finance transactions include collateralized debt obligations, such as mortgage-backed securities and credit card securitizations, debt equity hybrid securities, leases of all varieties, convertible bonds, and convertible preferred stock. Prepaid forward commodity transactions are also a form of structured finance. In forward commodity transactions, which are common in many industries, the parties enter into a contract for sales and deliveries of the commodity at future dates. A prepaid forward provides for payment to be made at the inception of that contract. From 1993 through 2001, Enron entered into a total of 11 more prepaid transactions involving Chase. 10 of the transactions were with Mahonia Limited, and one was with Mahonia Natural Gas Limited, both Jersey Channel Islands SPEs. All but one of these transactions were physically settled transactions, meaning that they were settled with deliveries of gas and oil. The last transaction was financially settled, meaning no commodity was delivered, although the cash payment was to be determined by the price of natural gas. Prior to continuing with the chronology, we would like to address Mahonia. Mahonia is beneficially owned by a charitable trust. Neither Chase nor Enron has any ownership interest in Mahonia. No employee or officer of Chase or Enron served as an officer or director or held shares in Mahonia. The directors and officers of Mahonia make the ultimate determination as to whether or not to enter into a transaction. Those directors and officers are neither appointed nor controlled by Chase or Enron. The use of entities like Mahonia is standard activity in structured finance.
One of the conditions for Enron being able to treat these truly debt transactions as benign trading liabilities for oil and gas trades was that the intermediary, Mahonia, had to be independent of both the banks and of Enron. While Mr. Della Pina did a splendid job of painting us a picture that that actually was the case, then-Senator Carl Levin of the Senate Investigative Committee soon points out that this picture is not at all accurate and that, in fact, the Chase Bank did have control over Mahonia via the so-called charitable trust that owns it.
First, this is from a firm, a law firm in the Channel Islands. Is that offshore folks that you work with? Morant says, our clients, Chase Bank and Trust Company Limited. So now Chase is the client of Morant, this offshore Channel Island. It represents Chase. And here's the letter that goes to the registrar of new corporations and trusts in Jersey. The letter says the following. Our clients, Chase Bank and Trust Company Limited, are considering promoting from time to time special purpose vehicles for use in particular banking transactions. The possible areas in which the SPVs could be used are numerous, but at this stage it can be foreseen that the likely use for them would be, and then the letter lists one of the reasons, is where a company wishes to raise finance not by way of borrowing but by way of a related transaction. That's number one. Now, the letter goes on to say, if you look at the top of page 2, for obvious reasons, it is important that the SPV, the special purpose vehicle, are controlled by Chase. It's important that the SPVs are controlled by Chase. And I want you to remember those words. But for accounting and other requirements, it's not desirable that they are wholly owned by Chase. Accordingly, Chase is considering establishing a charitable trust, which would own all the shares of a holding company, which in turn would wholly own the various SPVs. Here goes. Your lawyer says it's important SPVs are controlled by Chase. But for accounting and other requirements, it's not desirable that they be wholly owned by Chase. Accordingly, Chase is considering establishing a charitable trust. Chase is considering establishing a charitable trust, which would own all the shares of a holding company, which in turn would wholly own the various SPVs.
That's all for Wizards of Money Part 15. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org.